Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Bill Cook. Bill is a writer. He's an author. He's a professor of English at the University of La Verne in California. He's written a number of books. They include Cultural Expressions of Evil and Wickedness. Maybe he had Obama in mind. Psalms for the 21st Century and The Plight of the Palestinians. His newest one, as far as I know, is Decades of Deceit, 2002-2012, and Bill honored me by asking me to contribute to the book. It was a great honor for me to do it, Bill.
Well, I can appreciate that. That's as proud as I get. I really did, Steve, and I'm glad to be back with you. A little interim, not talking for a while there.
Oh, indeed. It's been too long since I last had you on, Bill. It seems to me that I asked a bit ago, and I think you were involved in a family wedding. Was that it at the time?
Well, we had one in January, yes. So there was a lot of stuff going on during that block of time, and I'm glad that now it's kind of passed by. Good things came of it, and I'm looking forward to a better year.
Oh, wonderful. And we're getting near the end of the school year, into the summer break, so things ease up a little bit then.
I just brought home a bag full of research papers and take-home finals, so I've got a lot of work to do.
Well, I remember it well on the other end, Bill. It's been a long time for me. I finished college in 1956 and graduate school in 1960. February 1960, so really was the end of 1959, and I think one of the happiest days of my life was over Thanksgiving weekend, 1959, when I finished my master's thesis full first draft, and I had a tough but very, very fair advisor. Took a course with him, an important course that I valued greatly, and he was marvelous. Asked me to make some changes, not too many. Oh, and in a matter of a couple of days, I incorporated everything he asked, and everything was rolling toward finally wrapping things up, which was in February. All I had to do was get through the finals, which seemed very aftermath at the time. And orals were very aftermath as well. Really, if you get through everything up to that point, nobody's going to shoot you down. Because you might have an outlier professor who maybe wants to ask you questions about material you took no coursework about on. That's exactly what happened to me. I had two friends who I took courses with, and I had another professor who taught a subject I never took anything in, and he asked a couple of questions I really didn't have much knowledge about. I did my best with them, but my friends came to my rescue. It turned out to really be a non-event. The graduation, Bill, was a non-event as well. June graduations are very special, but February ones, my God, I don't know why they even bothered holding them. We all gathered together in a room. There were quite a few of us. And they just milled around chatting with each other, and then they called everything to order. And all they did, this was the entire ceremony, all they did was call people up one by one. They had an array of university officials, professors and others there. They all shook our hands and said, congratulations, good luck. We had to get a cap and gown for all of this. We walked out. It was a very hot day. We shook our heads and said, we went through all that commotion just for a handshake.
Well, they sent you the diploma later, I'm sure.
Oh, they did. That's exactly what they did. But the college commencement, that was very, very special. That was out in the open air with many dignitaries, including foreign dignitaries attending. And I've mentioned on this program a number of times. 1956, Jack Kennedy was Massachusetts' junior senator at the time. He was my commencement speaker. Oh, he was marvelous, but I must say I was more focused on my graduation. But I went back and I read his speech years later, and I ended up writing about it. Politicians don't talk the way he did then, Bill. It was really a very marvelous talk. Politicians talk completely differently today than the way he did.
Well, he was from Massachusetts. He also talked differently from the rest of them.
Indeed, he did. Yeah. People to this day say, you sound just like Jack Kennedy.
Well, you left that kind of life and went into something else, and then you returned to your proper calling as a host and writer, and you've been doing it well ever since.
Well, Bill, I was involved in small family business most of my working life. For about half a dozen years, I was a marketing analyst out of the Wharton School. and got involved in small business after that. I retired at the end of 1999 at age 65. Never even imagined I'd be doing anything like I'm doing now. I mean, it literally just happened. It's because for the first time in my life, I got a home computer. I never had one before, and the computer changed my life. I advise anybody who doesn't have a computer, absolutely get one. Maybe you'll end up like I did. But I became an accidental writer, radio host. I just finished my fourth book, serving as editor and contributor to it, and wrapped it up yesterday, called Flashpoint in Ukraine, a very important book because of the very distinguished contributors that are involved in it. A major, major project, without any question, the definitive work on this topic, and it's because of the marvelous contributors who have expertise on the subject, and they're all in the book. They have marvelous chapters. They don't overlap. They tell a different aspect of a vitally important story, and we wrap things up. Yes, I thought they were wrapped up on May 1st to May 2nd. But we decided after the Odessa massacre that we would add information about that. And my Clarity editor suggested throughout, we had a conversation with one other person, one of the contributors, Paul Craig Roberts, and I volunteered to write something about the Odessa tragedy because I had written something about it. I expanded on what I wrote. I told a completely different story than the official one in the media that I didn't understand, and I'll just mention it briefly because it's so important to get in, Bill. I very much want to stress what's going on in Israel, Palestine, other issues that are on your mind. I mentioned to you about an hour ago in an email that there's an important Syrian presidential election coming up. Mm-hmm. I have an article already written on it. I haven't yet gotten out, but I will get it out. It's a very important election. There's no question. Assad is absolutely overwhelmingly popular. There are 23 other candidates. We can get into it. He'll win in a landslide. There's no question. And he'll be bashed irresponsibly. But what happened on Friday, the 2nd of May in Ukraine was an absolute horrific act of neo-Nazi violence, and I got it wrong. I went to web sources I consider responsible, and they reported what apparently they knew, but they got it wrong. And the initial reports began saying 31 people were killed. This was a massacre when ordinary Odessans, who certainly not separatists, not militants, ordinary people, simply people who want their democratic rights, they were trapped inside a trade union house building in Odessa. They went in there to protect themselves against neo-Nazi right sector thugs who trapped them in there. They barricaded themselves for protection. They had no idea that a lot of these thugs were already inside the building, that the operation that was going on was well planned by then. It was well planned in Kiev. It was well planned in Washington. And the initial reports of 31 dead, then 38 dead, then 46 dead, then 48 missing, those reports ended up all wrong. The real story was, again, this was well planned in advance. The people, the victims, had no idea what was going on. Somewhere on the order of 300 were murdered in cold blood. I don't think anybody is missing. Most of them were murdered inside the building. They were either shot at point-blank range, usually in the head, or they were beaten to death, or they were strangled to death, or they were thrown out of windows. They did not jump. The fire was cover-up. It had nothing, I repeat, nothing to do with what happened in Odessa. At most, it was on the first and third floors. It was a five-story building. Anybody inside could have easily escaped the fire. They could have gone to another floor. They could have gone to the roof. The police in Odessa were complicit with these neo-Nazi thugs. The fire department was complicit. They had a station minutes away. They took an hour, 90 minutes to show up. They waited until a very thick front door had burned through. They showed up when it was too late to matter. All these people were murdered. A pregnant woman was murdered. I saw graphic photographs and videos, including of the pregnant woman, actually half standing, half lying, leaning against the table, arched backward, with her head tilted upward, her mouth open, I believe, as I recall, pregnant, murdered in cold blood. I don't know if she was beaten to death, shot in the head, or strangled. This is what went on inside the building. And the stories complete, the real story, complete with graphic photos and videos, tells the real story, and I had to write about it. I included it in a separate chapter. I first included it, Bill, in my introduction, but my editor thought it was so important it should be a separate chapter, so we made it a separate chapter. It's one of the three chapters I have in the book. I only had two, and that's the way we decided we'd do it. But again, this story was so important that my Clarity editor decided she wanted to feature it in a separate article, and it is. It's a short article, but it tells a story. It tells a gruesome story. I just wanted to get the Odessa massacre story out, Bill, and I don't mean to hog the program. Let me let you jump in with what's on your mind.
Well, you don't mention that the American press is not talking about neo-Nazis that we're supporting.
I'm sorry, Bill, say that again.
You don't mention that the American press is not reporting anything about neo-Nazis that are supported by United States.
Oh, absolutely true. Absolutely true. I have written so many media critiques where I absolutely make a very strong point of this, and I've got another one coming for tomorrow.
I don't know how we can continue to do this. The American people are simply not given truth at all on the whole strategies that Israel, the United States in particular, are leveraging against the greater Middle East area. You know, when I wrote the, this will transition, I think, anyway, into Israel and the Palestinian talks that broke up with Israel, and the issues, it seems to me, when we talk on this level, and we started this some years back when the Arab Spring broke, Steve, you recall we were trying to speculate on how this is going to transpire, and it seems to have been fairly accurate to assume that the Israel, United States, and certain countries in the EU would jump in and begin to control the outcome of the people rising in the streets and trying to get their rights. And they would do it by divide and conquer. And that kind of thing has been the process by which the United States and the Israeli government, the Zionist Israeli government, have operated over time. You recall I edited a book in 2010 called The Plight of the Palestinians,
yes.
A Long History of Destruction, and it was a collection like yours of articles from world-renowned writers, and they unveiled the genocide taking place in Palestine by the occupying power. And the issue then came down to, well, why do we keep having peace talks? The reality is that, and it was published by Dr. Jeff Halper in that text, he went back and reviewed the history. And this is what he said, and I think it's important to begin here because the question is, why do we hold talks at all if they are not ever intending to have peace? Here's what he said. Israel's strategy until today is to bypass and encircle them, the Palestinians, making deals with governments that isolate and unsuccessfully so far neutralize the Palestinians as players. This is most tellingly shown in the Madrid peace talks when Israel only allowed Palestinian participation as part of the Jordanian delegation. It includes the Oslo peace process as well. While Israel insisted on a letter from Arafat explicitly recognizing Israel as a legitimate construct in the Middle East and later demanded a specific statement recognizing Israel as a Jewish state, both of which he got, no Israeli government ever recognized the collective rights of the Palestinian people to self-determination. Even Rabin was forthright on saying why. It means that a Palestinian state must by definition emerge, and Israel did not want to promise that. Which takes you back to the whole purpose and reason why we hold peace negotiations in the first place. And it gets more and more strange as time passes, because we realize that if you go back, and the introduction to that book, by the way, went back and demonstrated from the beginning, 1948, there was no intent on the part of the Zionists to ever have less than the whole of Palestine, mandate Palestine, free of Arabs. That's what it was all about. And it is to this day. There are no peace talks. You can't have peace talks when half of the people on the Palestinian side are not represented. You can't have peace talks by a gentleman named Mahmoud Abbas, who's not an elected official. He is paid for and taken care of by the Israelis, and in that sense, he has been called, and to many Palestinians, of course, he is something of a puppet. By the same token, he knows that if you're going to have to pay the piper, that means the United States, to get any money or to get anything out of the Israeli government, you have to go along with things. He went along with things this time. And the question is, what did he benefit from? And the other question is, how is Israel benefiting? Well, it's quite obvious that Israel is benefiting because it keeps adding, obviously, more and more settlements. It is a delaying tactic. It always has been. And when you look at what they have been accomplishing from their end, it's quite fascinating. They've authorized no less than 13,851 new housing units in the settlements. They've added available land for further settlement expansion, demolished 312 Palestinian homes. All this during the time when they were supposed to come up to April 29th and resolve a negotiated peace arrangement. I kept asking myself, what is it that allows a state that is capable of the horrific destruction of 2008-09 in Gaza, surrounding a piece of land that they control by virtual occupation. They control the air over the landmass, the old sea out beyond it. They own the land next to Egypt and around the borders of what they call Israel. All of that, it seems to me, is somewhat sick when you think of the consequences of what they did. They simply went with all the munitions that they had available, including white phosphorus, and they killed over 1,400 people. And they massacred 29 from one family that were in a UN school building. All of that kind of destruction begs the question, why? What is it that they really need to decimate a defenseless and helpless people when, in fact, they are the ones with the fourth state-of-the-art military in the world to protect 6 million people? And I'm an English teacher, you know that. I go back to literature in good times to try to find sources of behavior and analysis. And I went back to Franz Kafka, wrote a 10-page article for Counterpunch called The Do-Nothing Peace Machine. I don't know whether you saw it or not. But I said there's something that is being done here to pretend that you are going forward with negotiations when there's no honesty at all in the intent. Franz Kafka wrote a short little fragment, that's what it's called, a fragment, a cryptic thing about an emperor, an imperial palace, and a wall to protect the emperor and his people. And unfortunately, there are infidel nations who gather around the palace and shoot the emperor. The story is moral, if you like, is that ultimately there is no protection. There is only ongoing fear that any action to protect is doomed. and guilt is never to be doubted. Fear exists inside the wall. Always fear, inside and out, of self and all others. When you get to that kind of analysis, you realize that Chiron built a wall of fear in his 400-mile wall to surround the Palestinians. And there are two curious aspects about that. It gives offense to both those on both sides of the fence, of the wall. It offends the moral sensibilities of any civilized person as well, anywhere in the world. And ironically, having built that wall in order to surround the Palestinians, they then moved inside it. It's their wall. It's illegal. It's incursive beyond the green line. But it did suggest that there was the existence of a Palestinian state, and now they realize we can't have that. That means that there seems to be borders for a state we've never recognized. And they have moved, therefore, inside, and they've changed the name so that, despite the fact that there's a wall, it's not the West Bank any longer that has a wall around it. It is Samaria and Judea. And the names can change the reality for those that know very little about what is taking place in all of that. And every time we end up with a new president, we also end up, obviously, with a new peace initiative. And that was true in 2007. I wrote articles on that when the Annapolis peace effort was taken, and you did the same thing. And it seems to me that what we're witnessing is the ability of the United States and Israel to push for something called a peace negotiations, when in fact it is simply a delaying tactic. And when you realize now that the Palestinians have taken the initiative to sign 15 protocols to become a member, a more active member status in the UN, curiously, they did not include the ICCJ, the International Criminal Court of Justice, or the Rome Statute, which you would think they would do, because both of those opened the door to bringing charges against the occupying power that holds down their land and has absconded with it by confiscation or the necessity for defense security. Your question then is, well, what is the value of that? Who benefits from that? And I think what we're going to find is that Israel is going to be faced with having to confront the world and either go back to the Resolution 242 and the agreed-upon boundaries of 1967 so that the state will be established, or it has to defy in open court the reality of the 160-some resolutions made by the United Nations General Assembly condemning their illegal occupation and theft of the Palestinian land and all of the other international laws that they have broken in the process. So the question then is, what's Israel going to do about that? And it seems to me that they have created a set of circumstances which offers really only one option, and that is one state. And hence the Jewish state will have to face the fact that it can't be a Jewish state, or they have to consider and reconsider the 1967 boundaries, which, by the way, the Arab countries have agreed upon back in 2002, and they have reasserted that policy for peace again recently. And so those are the options And I see more potential for probable success if Palestine removes itself from the U.S. as any broker of any legitimacy. Israel then faced with itself and the U.N. Having to confront justice in the international arena. And as far as I'm concerned, Israel defies justice, and therefore it's not really a legitimate state. It breaks the international law on its face. And, of course, they keep claiming that they're being tagged as illegitimate. Well, they've tagged themselves, from my perspective, as illegitimate. And the only way they can get out of that is to face confrontation of their allegations before the international courts.
Bill,
I agree. I'm sorry for that.
I agree with you right down the line. Everything you said is absolutely true, beginning with the sham peace talks. They began, actually, few people remember that, I don't remember, but I wrote about the progression of so-called peace talks over the year. They began in 1949 in Lausanne, Switzerland, when the United Nations proposed to both sides, this was after the 48 war, proposed to both sides, the Palestinians and the Israelis, a very responsible, simple resolution of the conflict to really institutionalize peace and just put an end to conflict. And the Palestinians were willing, even though they lost 78% of their country, and Israel categorically refused, and multiple rounds of peace talks from then to the present day really were absolute shams. The greatest hoax in modern times is the only way to describe them. And the idea that any Palestinian so-called leader would go along with this exposes him as a co-conspirator with Israel's policy. And I've said on this program and emphasized and written about it that Mahmoud Abbas had his 2005 election rigged by Israel. He has no legitimacy whatever. His term expired in January 2009. It's already, my God, 5.5 years later, he's still there. He's still serving Israeli interests. He still betrays his own people. He was involved in the 1993 Oslo talks, I believe in the 1991 Madrid talks. The books were cooked to favor Israel. Israel got everything it wanted. Palestinians got absolutely zero. To this day, they've gotten absolutely zero. And I remember quoting former Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir back in the 1980s saying he looked forward to dragging out peace talks for 10 years so Israel could steal all the Palestinian land it wanted.
That's right. And by the way, you mentioned Oslo. Clinton recently, the president seemed to do this after they're out of office, Carter did, he wrote a book about apartheid, and Clinton apparently has now said that Israel was responsible for the breakdown of Oslo, not the Palestinians. When he was in office, it was always the Palestinians. And something's happened to Obama as well. He had, and there are WikiLeaks papers on this, told Mahmoud Abbas at the very beginning of his term, we'll get peace over there in the two-state solution in my first term. And all of a sudden, of course, he can't pull it off at all. And he can't pull it off in good measure, not only because he capitulates to the power of the Israeli lobbies and money, but also to the fact that that same lobbies and money are buying our Senate and our Congress. And it's so obvious because there's virtually no one who will vote against any resolution written by AIPAC or a staff member that's assigned the job in order to do it according to their desires. And that becomes a stain on anything that regarding what we call elections and consent of the people, because the people do not want to do what we're doing, but we're doing it regardless, and Israel is the owner of the United States government. There's a way of transitioning here, if you'd like to the BDS, because I think one of the things that we have as a result of the piece that's breaking down is
the
arrival.
The Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Initiative?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, indeed. I'll just put an exclamation point very briefly on what you said, Bill. The idea that, anybody thinks that there could be any resolution of the longstanding Israeli-Palestinian conflict based on the way things are going now, with the U.S. absolutely one-sidedly favoring Israel and wanting absolutely no rights whatever for Palestinians, regardless of what John Kerry says and any other U.S. officials, the chances for peace between both parties is absolutely, all capital letters, zero. Zero. I wish I could put money on it, Bill. It would be an easy bet to cash in on.
Well, I wrote about this because I have the top secret file of Richard C. Catling, who was the deputy assistant of the Mandate Police. And he has six areas of illegal behavior being performed by the Zionist Jewish agency from 35 all the way up until 48. And in those seized documents by the police, there are statements that we're at war with you. If you don't do what we want done, you'll lose. We're going to war with you. And people say, well, they didn't have enough. They had up to 80,000 trained troops. Britain was in no position to fight them. They, in fact, were fighting their own government because the Israelis had, as they have here and as they have now in Britain, a controlling set of lobbies that was threatening Britain. So the government itself was at war with its own soldiers in Mandate Palestine. And it's a horrible picture to see. I mean, these are terrorists of a kind that outclass any terrorism we do now. They bombed the King David. That was a false flag operation. They kidnapped and killed and booby-trapped the bodies of British soldiers. They blew up trains and bridges. They stored ammunition in rooms beneath the playgrounds of kids and air vented them through the teeter tot up on the ground. All that stuff's in this file, and that kind of awareness of terrorism by the Jewish groups is not known very well at all in the American historical frame of what's taken place over there. They are a democracy, that it is claimed. Well, they're not a democracy. They don't have borders. They keep adding, and simply confiscating whatever land they need to confiscate. And their argument, we have a right to defend our people. Well, the Palestinians have no right to defend their people, apparently. And what's the reason? Well, there are terrorist groups. Well, they're terrorists because they label them terrorists, and you can't label a state a terrorist, and therefore, that's by definition, it's not by reality, but because you can't, that's where my English background comes in. It's handy to be able to know that you can call one person a terrorist, but you can't call George W. Bush a terrorist, although he was operating the greatest terrorist Mr. Cheney you'd ever want to see.
Indeed, I want to emphasize the fact that you mentioned Israel has no borders. Israel is the only nation in the world. There were no others. Israel is the only nation that has no borders. It also has no constitution. Basic laws. Well, basic laws. I mean, they're just like statute laws. No constitution, no borders. The border issue is because Israel wants its borders expanded and not just stealing all of Palestine, the rest of Judea and Samaria that it wants. It wants parts of surrounding countries. It wants parts of Lebanon. It wants parts of Syria. It wants parts of Jordan. It wants parts of Egypt. This is long-standing policy that goes back decades.
Well, it goes back to Sharon in Beirut.
Oh, for sure it does.
The courts.
1982, I believe.
Yeah.
Oh, that hideous invasion, 17,000 people murdered. Sharon was defense minister at the time.
Yeah, he was sitting upstairs watching the show with Klieg lights on. It was a brutal slaughter. I've been to those camps, and I mean, to this day, they are blotches on the landscape. And it, by the way, this could be a way to get into your Syrian election for a minute. The Syrian refugees that were from the Palestinian refugee camps, 41 of them were just deported back to Syria out of Lebanon, even though the Lebanese government at first had said, we will accept the Palestinians that are being forced out. But they have changed that, and they've gone back and decided to throw them out. That is, too, against international law. Refugees are, by virtue of their incredible status of having no place, no home, no passport from their own country, no country, that's a UN problem, but the UN will not face it. And perhaps by going to the international courts, the Palestinians this time can force the UN to take on the responsibility of what it should have done decades ago and simply moved in and said that we must abide by international law. You can't have people scattered in all kinds of countries where they have no passports, no recognition as citizens, no opportunities to get jobs that are considered legitimate. They can't buy land. This is true in Lebanon of the Palestinians. So generation after generation, the children grow up, and they are essentially slaves confined to a walled-in mass of cinder block buildings, littered and strewn with sewage and bulldozers and rocks that have simply made living accommodations impossible. It is truly tragic.
Well, it really is tragic, Bill, and the fact that this has gone on since before 1948, even before 1947, but the war against Palestinians began in 1947. It was well planned. There were a number of plans. They were called plans A, B, C, and D, Dalit in Hebrew, and that was the final plan before Ben-Gurion, who was the future Israeli first prime minister. He was the one behind it all, but he had other like-minded extremists around him. And they planned this war, total war without mercy. Something on the order of 800,000 Palestinians were either displaced or murdered in cold blood. And along with everything else that happened, there were major atrocities committed. There were women raped. This is what the Israelis did to the Palestinians. They considered Palestinians subhumans. The notion that Palestinians would ever come back is an absolutely verboten thought in the minds of Israelis. International law grievously violated, and this went on then, and it continues in what I call slow motion genocide ever since. Gaza is the worst example, but the West Bank is horrific as well, and I've written many times about every single day, without exception, there are multiple Israeli soldiers' incursions into Palestinian communities. They can be 3 a day. They can be 10 a day. I've seen as many as 90 in 1 week. 90 in a week. My God, my math is bad. What is that, about a dozen a day? Innocent people, civilians, their homes are broken into pre-dawn, the family members are roughed up, the homes are ransacked, the property is damaged or destroyed, people are irresponsibly arrested, children are treated like adults, women are treated like men. This stuff goes on every single day. Is there anything in the major media, in Western media, especially U.S. media about this? Virtually zero. Once in a while, a little squib here, a little squib there, but Israel gets wholehearted, one-sided support, including from Washington, including from Western capitals, and Palestinian suffering continues horrifically. Thankfully, they have lots of people on the street around the world who supports them. You're one of them, Bill. So am I. I write often on Israel-Palestine. It's one of my major topics.
You know, I just had an email this morning from a fellow who had read an article that was part of my book. I have two other books on the Bush administration, Tracking Deception, Bush Policy in the Mideast. and then The Rape of Palestine. And those are collections of the articles over time that track what we and Sharon and Olmert were doing. One of the articles deals with non-democracy that exists in Israel. And he had been called anti-Semitic, and he says, is that a legitimate argument against what I'm saying, while I'm trying to point to the fact that there are no borders, there is no constitution, there is no equality before the courts, and there is a complete breakdown of international law in the process. And, of course, I sent him a note, so you better get on the radio and find out if you can get to the Progressive Radio, because we're going to deal with this issue. The reality of the United States is that it is a controlled government, it is a controlled press, and we do not get the truth. It is so shameful that, and I'm going to go here for a minute for the action of two of our representatives, Peter Roskam and Dan Lipinski, both of them out of Illinois, and they have put together a, as a response to the American Studies Association vote to boycott the Israeli academic institutions. It's called House H.R. 4009, and it would block federal funding for American universities engaging in a boycott of Israeli academic institutions or scholars to ensure that taxpayer dollars are not used to fund bigoted attacks against Israel that undermine the fundamental principles of academic freedom. That is the claim. Now, what the interesting thing to me is that these two characters have not read what the American Studies Association has cited as rationale for the boycott, and they haven't done any homework on the reality of what Israel has done to decimate higher education in Palestine. When this all opened back in the right after the 48, they didn't have universities in Palestine, but they did begin to build them. But they could access outside universities in London and Germany and the United States and elsewhere. Now, that isn't so easy. As a matter of fact, it's almost prevented. So I wrote an article about this. And the article is one that provides a lot of historical background on the development of institutions of higher learning and the actions by the Israeli state to prevent it. And it even gets down to not just forcing them to get fees and laws that allow them to construct something. It gets down to what is it you are going to present in your curriculum. On top of that, there is a summary that has been made of legal study by the Human Sciences Research Center of South Africa on Israeli apartheid actions there, and one of them has to do with the fact that their actions against the state of the people of Palestine in preventing their access to higher education has included everything down to the destruction of the institutions themselves. The Gaza bombing wiped out science buildings, libraries, and other buildings on the campuses in the universities there. And no one mentions that. No one mentions the kind of codified law that Israel has for preferred identity. That is an apartheid identification. And, of course, if you're going to be a Jewish state and you are not Jewish, you're not the same. The state then segregates the population.
That's exactly right. Bill,
I would add a contrast
that Iran is called an Islamic Republic, but people of other religions in Iran have their religions respected, including, I don't know the exact number of Jews in Iran. It may be on the order of 25,000 or so, but I've written very briefly, it's been a good while, that in the past, Iranian Jews were asked if they prefer to leave Iran and move to Israel, and the overwhelming response was no. They wanted to stay right where they were.
Right. Well, I think this is the issue that we're dealing with. Is it an apartheid state? There's no question it's an apartheid state, and this report proves it using the very definitions and using the statistical information and the evidence in order to establish it by authorities who have been through this process before in South Africa. But the American press is not going to do much to make that kind of thing known, nor do the people who are going to, in our Congress, raise issues against institutions, including myself. Can I, therefore, prevent any further study, any further research? Is it going to impact me so I can't do what I need to do? Because I have written about this, and they will simply say that I am anti-Semitic and use that as a means to prevent freedom of speech, freedom of research, freedom of inquiry, freedom of discussion, debate, everything that is essential if you are really a higher education institution. What the American Studies Association pointed to is the silence from the Israeli academics. They do not question. And yet when Germany was acting against the Jews, the cry then was, where are the academics? Where is the questioning of what the government is doing? It tends to repeat itself, and it's such a horrible reality in all.
Bill, I agree exactly. I wrote about the ASA and what they did. I wrote at least two articles about it, rather detailed, and what they did had nothing to do with academic freedom. They targeted Israeli institutions, not the academic staff. They respect academic freedom, and they were vilified for acting responsibly, and they weren't the only one who did it. There were other initiatives. There was at least one major one before the ASA, and there have been others, including in Europe. Bill, before the program ends, I do want to get something in about the upcoming Syria election, if I may.
Okay.
There is an election planned for June 3rd. In 2012, there was a very fair and open parliamentary election. There was a brand new Syrian constitution the same year. I forget the precise months. One of them was in February, I believe, 2012. I believe the other one was in May. Very responsible, independently monitored. The constitution alone, Bill, the Syrian people alone had a chance to vote on a referendum, up or down, whether they wanted this or they didn't want it, and they want a change in the initial draft. There were changes made. There was something like 14 new articles included. There were others that were changed to represent the interests of the people. Press freedom was institutionalized in the Constitution for the first time in Syrian history. It was a remarkable achievement that went on in 2012. And, of course, Western media and Western governments bashed what happened as farcical, which they will bash after the June 3rd presidential election. For the first time, Assad will engage in or any Syrian leader will engage in an open and fair democratic election. There are 24 aspirants. Bashar al-Assad is one of them, and I haven't seen a recent poll, but he is overwhelmingly popular in Syria, and I believe it. If I was a Syrian, I would vote for him. I don't know a lot about these other people. Some of them, I'm sure, are good people. Some of them are not good people, but Assad will win in a landslide. It's just a question of how great a landslide. What will be the aftermath of the election? It'll be for a seven-year term. He's had two terms. It'll be for a third term. It'll run, I believe, to mid-July 2021. But it's up to the Syrian people to decide. Months ago, he said he would not stand for re-election unless Syrians wanted him to. They do want him to. He submitted his application according to Syrian law and constitutional law and general election law on the 28th of April. The other candidates did before the May 1 deadline, June 3rd. June 3rd is the date. I believe that's a Sunday. I'll be following the results very closely. I'll be writing about them. I have an article already written in advance. I'll get it out shortly. I've been so pressed with cutting-edge things that I need to get out as quickly as possible, then an election on the 3rd can wait a few more days before I need to send it out and explain to my readers exactly what's planned, exactly what I think will unfold. It would be very, very responsible, and Assad has made very responsible comments. He literally wants more of Syria's resources going toward humanitarian efforts to help the people of Syria, because Syria is at war, and in numerous articles I've written about Syria, I make no bones saying this is Obama's war. It's Obama's war against the Syrian people. He launched it around February, March 2011. Most of the fighters are mostly foreign invaders. They're U.S. death squads, mercenaries, ravaging the country, destroying it, murdering civilians, committing gruesome atrocities. Assad has been wrongly accused of using chemical weapons multiple times. The evidence shows clearly he never once, I repeat, never once, a single time, ever used chemical weapons. There's overwhelming evidence that Saudi Arabia and U.S.-supplied chemical weapons were used by these insurgents, these death squads, to commit chemical weapons attacks against the Syrian people. And again, the evidence is there in black and white. I wrote about it a number of times. All suppressed in the major media, the Western media, never in the alternative media, but we're going to see fireworks, I think, maybe leading right up to the election, right after the election. The war continues. It's a very gruesome war. There was a horrific attack in Aleppo, the largest city in Syria today, the major commercial capital, and attacks around Damascus continues. It's a horrific situation for ordinary Syrians who want peace. And Assad, I'm sorry, Bashar al-Assad, and I get Assad and Mahmoud Abbas mixed up all that. I made a mistake in one article I wrote, and a reader called it to my attention, so I corrected it. But it's Assad in Syria, it's Abbas in Palestine, and they're both polar opposite leaders. Abbas is a conspirator with Israel. Assad is a real defender of his people, and I absolutely support his rights and his initiative, and I hope he's reelected. We've got about a minute left, Bill. Your final
comment. Have you noticed how the United States and Israel seem to have a real problem with elections?
Oh, indeed. So if they don't come out the way they want them to?
They never say, well, let's have the people vote. Ahmadinejad used to say, let's have the people vote. But apparently our democracy doesn't allow for that. We make decisions, well, the Hamas are terrorists, and therefore we won't negotiate with them. Arafat is an impossible man to work with, so we won't deal with him.
So,
in other words, we haven't got the people that we want in place. We simply don't make it happen that way.
Bill,
we don't need
the Arafat. The music needs, I got to sign off.
Okay.
The music is my master. Bill, it was a great, great program. I look forward to having you back.
Okay, I'll talk to you again.
Thank you, Bill. We'll be archiving again on Friday. Archives should be in my archives on the same day. Sunday, every Sunday, live at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Take it away, Glenn.